It's all over the news again. Obesity is a major concern for government officials, celebrities, and activists. A Disney exhibit recently closed after being accused of stigmatizing overweight kids. Michelle Obama is talking about changes to school lunches. TV shows and magazines are shouting at us to get fit before swimsuit season. Dr. G and I will be sorting out facts from fiction this week on Family Anatomy.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologist.
So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you could get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And today we are talking about, as you heard at the beginning, obesity.
We're talking about obesity, but you know, the funny thing is when I started looking into it to do the research for the show, that is,
right,
I started realizing it's not just a term that's out there, like that people say, oh, that person is obese. There's actually a definition of it.
There is a clinical definition of obesity, and we talked before about body image, and when we were talking about body image, we talked a little bit about weight issues and things like that. And how boys and girls are different, or men and women are different in terms of their body image issues. But this is the first time we sat down to talk about weight, really, obesity.
Like researchers, I guess, look at it as overweight. And then once you go over a certain body mass index, mm-hmm. we can talk about that too, then you're considered obese.
Right.
So there's these two categories. And there's also underweight.
Yeah.
You know? Now, when I was looking at it, if you're underweight, again, according to this way to rate what your height versus your weight is, mm-hmm. this body mass index,
right,
you're actually at increased risk for a lot of diseases if you're underweight or overweight and then obese, right?
Sure. That's. I mean, it's kind of funny too, though, because there's been recent research talking about that idea of calorie-restricted diets, and if you eat 30% less than you're supposed to for your BMI, I guess you could say that it has some benefits for longevity, but there may be some costs in other areas.
Well, this is according to the government website that talks about, you know, the Canadian health strategy on this issue,
right?
And you know, if your BMI is your height over your weight squared.
Okay. Yeah. You're a little square, I notice. What's your BMI anyway?
My BMI, you know what's funny is I checked it out. It's within the normal range, but just barely.
Wow.
It's just barely within normal.
You can't see us. You're listening to us right now, but Giuseppe is like, he's got 2% body fat going on. He's like a some kind of gorilla juice head over here.
If I was to gain like only 5 extra pounds, I would be into the category called overweight.
Which is a BMI of?
Which is a BMI of 25 to 29.9.
Right.
And then like 30 and over is considered obese.
Okay.
Okay. If you're between 18.5 and 24.9 BMI, then you're considered normal weight, which is the least risk for health issues.
Mm-hmm.
If you're 18.5 BMI and under, or under 18.5, then you're also at increased risk for health problems.
Wow. And they had to use, this BMI statistic was developed because you can't just go by weight, because people of different heights obviously are going to have a different ideal weight. And those BMI measurements, I think they change over time, what's acceptable changes over time. Like older people can have a different BMI than younger people, right?
Well, that's it. And I think, you know, it's they have to change the formula a little bit, or it doesn't quite apply to different groups, like, you know, pregnant women, of course.
Yeah.
It wouldn't apply to them, or seniors, or even kids. There's not an internationally recognized sort of definition for what would be the appropriate BMI for kids.
Yeah, because they're still growing and changing and developing, right? They're going to have different, and they have different nutritional needs because of that.
That's right.
So what they're going to eat, everything's going to be different for kids.
That's right. But the interesting thing is that underweight, you never hear about underweight so much because, you know, we live in Western societies where that doesn't tend to be the big issue. The big issue is overweight and obesity. And I guess that's why we call the show Anatomy of Obesity.
And well, yeah, because obesity is a pretty big issue, and it has been in the news recently. I mean, like I said at the beginning, they're talking about school. The First Lady of the United States is talking about school lunches, even here in Ontario, right? The government of Ontario is legislating what kinds of foods are allowed to be served for hot lunches in schools, what kinds of foods are allowed to be in vending machines at elementary schools. It's a little bit looser at the high school level, but there are a lot of rules now that we didn't have before.
Well, this is only in the past, I think, 3 or 4 years that this has happened.
Oh, yeah. Even more recently than that, I think, in terms of the hot lunch stuff.
The vending machines, I think, was it maybe
the vending machines,
3 years, right?
Yeah, the vending machines was a while ago, and then the hot lunch was more recently, and now even they're touchier about things like bake sales and the kinds of fundraising that schools used to do because they feel like, I guess, it gives a mixed message.
Right.
And that there's a problem with that too, because I don't know if you've read this kind of research on this topic, but the problem with legislating school lunches is that by the time kids start school, their eating habits are already more or less established. So what you're feeding them at school doesn't necessarily change their eating habits at home, which means it might not have the desired impact. Although I guess you're not supporting and promoting
you're
those
not
unhealthy
compounding
eating.
It, I guess, yeah. I mean, there's not a big issue with being underweight, at least, you know, in affluent societies. 43 million children are considered overweight in the world. That's like a 2010 statistic. That 43 million children, you know, it's a lot of children.
If you look at, I looked at a table in Forbes magazine today as I was preparing for the show, and they rated the countries that had the most overweight, the highest percentage of overweight people. And the U.S. was
number one.
No, they weren't number one. They were ninth. U.S. was ninth on the list, but they had like 74% of the American population were carrying an unhealthy weight. They had the BMI over 25. And Canada was number 35, and we had over 60% of our population is carrying that 25 or higher BMI.
Well, you see, I looked at a different table, and mine wasn't just over. You were looking at overweight.
Yes, not just obesity.
I was just looking at obesity,
right,
which is over 30 BMI.
So I was looking at over 25.
That's right. So when you look at this is interesting, though. So I didn't see your table. You didn't see mine.
Interesting.
In yours,
yes.
Just because it was overweight,
mm-hmm,
right? Which, like I said, if you look at me, people aren't going to think I'm overweight. If I gained only a few pounds, I would be into that category. So, you know, it's pretty, you know.
Yeah, I think there was some criticism of the BMI index for that reason, right? That those cutoffs of 25 and maybe, well, I don't know if 30 is a controversial one, but the idea that somebody like you who could be that close to being overweight, and I'm probably closer to 26 on
the
BMI,
probably,
right,
around the same area that I am.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, part of the reason it's structured in this way is because research has shown that there's increased health risks, even with a little bit of weight extra on
the body.
That's
right. That's right.
So, but and one that I looked at, because it's obesity and not just overweight, so these are people who are much farther along on the continuum.
Right. Those 5 points mean a lot.
That's it. So the number one country there is the U.S.
Mm.
And 30.6% of U.S. Citizens are considered obese, right?
Wow.
Number two is Mexico. That kind of surprised me.
Mm.
Number three was the U.K. at 23%. Canada was at 11 at 14%. They only had 28 countries on this list. 25 mm-hmm. was Italy.
Okay. And what I sent you an article today called Eat Like an Italian.
That's right. Yeah. And this goes to show you. So 28 was Japan and South Korea at 3.2%.
My goodness.
People are obese.
Do you eat Japanese food? Is that going to help us, do you think?
If we just eat sushi?
Maybe I should have sent you.
Eat it?
Maybe I should have sent you an article called Eat Like a Japanese Person. Like, stop eating like an Italian.
I mean, really, half the reason you eat sushi is because it's good for you, right? It's not because it's tasty, is that?
No, I like sushi, yeah.
Yeah, I'm joking.
Tastes good.
But you can see how, you know, I picked Italy in there.
Of course you did.
Right? Not because I'm biased or anything.
Not in any way.
Anyway.
Your name does end with the vowel.
Well, listen, because we are talking about access to food that's high in fat, high in sugar, high in salt, processed food.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. has the highest access to that kind of food,
right,
of any nation on earth.
Yep.
And I know that, I think it was back in the 1980s, a McDonald's opened up in Rome.
In the 1980s, Rome, they waited Italy. That long.
That's right.
Wow.
And there were protests in the streets.
Protests in the streets big about opening McDonald's.
Yes.
Wow.
Big protests in the streets. And I don't know if you've
heard didn't live there then, though.
I didn't.
No.
Okay. I was visiting at the time, though.
At the time of the protests?
No, I didn't.
You were there to protest McDonald's?
No, I was doing something else at the time. But
okay.
I was there in the 80s.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the slow food movement?
It rings a bell, but I don't know anything about it.
Just even the title by itself tells you what it's about in a way. It's
Eat
it's
more
the
slowly.
Opposite. No, well, it's the opposite of fast food.
Ah. Right?
So it's taking time, taking care, mm-hmm. eating organic food, eating, yeah. you know.
Not so processed. Not processed.
Right.
Ready-made.
That started in Rome as a result, as a reaction to a McDonald's opening up.
Isn't that funny?
McDonald's, not, I know that's your last name, but you have nothing to do with that.
Hey, I'm a Mac, not a Mick. Yeah, I'm Scottish.
So there you go. I think there is a correlation there with the accessibility to some of these.
It's funny you say that. Yeah, I work at the university. I teach at the University of Ottawa here, and they have a food truck right outside the building where I work. Now, usually by the time I get there, it's already all closed and locked up, so I don't really know what kind of food they're serving. But their big thing on the side was slow food fast. That was their advertising slogan, see?
Wow, so, marketing. Marketing can always change.
So they're thinking about the same thing that you were, the slow food movement.
They are.
But
now,
it'd be nice if they could get it done faster, because I'm hungry, for Pete's sake.
Did you read this too? That some of these statistics are kind of startling. 50 to 65% of Americans, depending on where you look,
right,
and the statistics, are either overweight or obese. Mm-hmm. 50 to 65%.
Well, and I was just talking, you know, 74% according to that Forbes, the table from Forbes, which is based on a representative.
Overweight? Was that overweight?
Sorry, 25 and higher. BMI 25 and higher.
Okay, which is overweight.
Which is overweight. That's what you just told me, yeah.
See, yeah. So I guess it's where you look. Either one of these statistics, though, is...
Well, still, that's a big, you know, it's a majority of people in a country are overweight. And that may be one of the reasons why there were complaints about this BMI measure, is because it's saying, well, guess what? The average person in the United States is overweight. So and I guess there's a question of whether you're basing these kinds of cutoff scores on the norm or on what's expected or what's healthy.
Well, that's it. And I guess they're leaning on the side of what's healthy.
Yeah. And BMI has been increasing. I don't know if maybe we read the same things, maybe we didn't. Obviously, we've read some different things, but I found one study that looked at data from 1959 to 2002, and they found starting in the 1990s, there was a sharp increase in BMI for teenagers, young adolescents, and in the 2000s, it was young adults whose BMI was increasing, and they couldn't really connect for sure to say, like, 10 years later, is it those same ones who were kids who were just entering adolescence at the time whose BMI went up and they just stayed heavier, or is there some new factor that's increasing in the early 2000s? But BMI is on the rise.
In the past, this is what I got, in the past 25 years, obesity rates have tripled in the United States. Tripled.
Tripled.
Tripled. So it can't just be psychological factors that are at play here if it's tripling over the course of 25 years.
I thought it could. I mean, psychology is pretty powerful, man. I think
it is. And we will be talking about it because that's our show.
That's what we talk about, psychology. It's very important.
But societal factors definitely have a strong role to play here.
Somewhere out there, a sociology podcast is saying, yes, we got them. We're going to win now.
So 60 million people are dieting in the United States.
It's a huge industry.
It's a huge industry.
Well, and you see exercise equipment and diet supplements and things like that on infomercials constantly. I'm sure I saw one just last Saturday. You see Jenny Craig constantly. And I mean, they make jokes about it.
That's it. Now, you know, here's the other, you know, we're doing a lot of statistics here. This will be my last statistic.
Please. Okay. Instead of history, we're talking statistics today.
Yes, statistics. Well, a little bit of history. I took you all the way back to the 80s.
Hey, and I did say 1959 once.
90 to 95% of people who are involved in weight loss programs will regain the weight over the longer term.
Yeah, weight loss. I mean, we know that dieting is not often very successful. And even on those commercials I was talking about, it always says in fine, tiny print on the bottom that you can only see if you have excellent vision like I do, that results may vary. These results are not typical, right?
Results may vary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can lose 0 to this many pounds.
That's right. Or minus, yeah. You can gain. And, you know, there was a study that I found that talked about how if you're dieting and engaging in unhealthy weight loss behaviors like skipping meals, eating very little, mm-hmm. For men, more food substitutes, and for women, more diet pills, these kinds of unhealthy weight loss behaviors.
Yeah, those are shortcuts that don't tend to be good solutions.
Well, over the course of 10 years, they followed teens into early adulthood, mm-hmm. right? Over mm-hmm. 10 years, you actually will increase in weight.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is a really sad story we're going to leave off today with. Wow, there's no hope. I mean, you can't diet. Exercise isn't going to work.
If you're doing some of these
things,
I mean, you know, you
just
don't want to
eat food slowly and cook food slowly.
And go to Rome.
And just, and protest against fast food restaurants.
Not a bad suggestion for a number of reasons.
Well,
really,
I know.
Not just for this.
I can give you the suggestion to go to Rome and you'd be packing your bags right now.
I mean,
would love to go to Rome.
Halfway through the podcast, I could do that.
You probably would do that too and leave me hanging. But that's not what we want to do, because I think it is important to kind of look at, maybe there are some factors that might be risk factors, right? And I know the medical community talks about genetic risk factors for sure. Are there things that, because, I mean, we're the Family Anatomy podcast, we often talk about, well, what can parents do? What is there anything that could happen within a family that might be helpful? So that's one of the things that I wanted to look at, where what are some things that predict obesity? Now, obviously, it's multifaceted, and there are lots of different predictors, but one of the things that I found in, do you know there's International Journal of Pediatric Obesity? Did you know about this?
I have the Journal of Pediatric Obesity. I don't know if that had that International Journal of Pediatric Obesity.
So there's multiple journals of pediatric obesity, because mine is international.
It's the same. Is it a 2010 study from San Diego that you're referring to?
I'm talking about a 2011 study about sensitivity.
Oh.
And what these folks found was that when moms were not sensitive to their kids, you know, the more authoritarian kind of parenting as opposed to the authoritative democratic parenting where you're warm and sensitive, but you also have high expectations.
Right.
Right. So if parents were less sensitive, well, moms in this study, if the moms were less sensitive, their kids were more likely to be overweight.
So that's funny, because I have a study which says almost the exact same thing you're saying about kids and their moms, but this is about couples. And so what they did, this is a 2011 study from the University of Texas. What they did is they followed couples and gave them questionnaires about how they're communicating to one another,
mm-hmm.
and what effect that has on weight loss.
Interesting.
And what they found is the most effective messages that you can give your mate are caring, concern, and a challenge, which is sort of what you just said.
Right. High expectations and warmth.
Challenge would be the high expectations, and the mm-hmm. caring concern would be the warmth.
Mm-hmm.
The ineffective messages convey punishment and non-acceptance.
Right. Shame doesn't work.
And you get more weight gain there.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, it goes around the other way, right?
Now, you know, you kind of think to yourself, well, is this news? You know what I mean? Is this news? But if you think about some of the people, some people that you know, that your experience in your life and the way they've handled the people around them,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they go out purposely to say they're going to be punishing in the way they react.
Right.
But there is a certain amount of stigma towards people who are overweight.
Well, this is it.
You can sort of get away with doing some of these things. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
This person I know, right, tells his sister that she's overweight quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the rationale that he uses is that, well, if I don't tell her, who else will? Now, he doesn't just say that she's overweight. Like, he says it in a kind of a, you know, in a punishing way. Like, I can't believe how you look. Just look at yourself. You're overweight, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
But he feels he's doing her a favor because nobody else would tell her. And it is bad for her health and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
However, it doesn't work.
Right.
It doesn't help her feel good about herself or get her weight under control. It just makes her feel badly. And like I said, in the study, it's counterproductive.
Well, and you hear about that with parents and kids all the time, because parents don't necessarily, any more than a husband knows, if you notice that your child is becoming overweight, you don't necessarily know what's the best way to handle that. I mean, that's why this kind of research is important. Of course, when we say being sensitive is essential and it's more effective, it makes sense. But at the same time, I mean, you and I probably didn't have to deal with this as much because we're guys, but, you know, I can think of lots of women I know who were getting messages as they were going up into the teenage years and they were starting to develop about, are you sure you want to be eating that? Which isn't necessarily punishing, but it's not very sensitive, maybe.
That's right. It's giving a message that I'm noticing that you're overweight and it's a problem for you.
But there's something wrong.
And there's something wrong.
But there's something wrong. And if you're not overweight, but your parents are concerned because they don't want things to go that route because they want you to be healthy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, well, what are you supposed to do, right? And so sensitivity is one thing that predicted a lower likelihood of kids developing in developing weight problems, I guess you could say. But I found one other thing that I thought, well, I mean, I looked at a bunch of different research studies, but I found one that really jumped out at me, and it was a meta-analysis.
Oh, we like and those.
You know, we like meta-analyses because it's one study that takes a whole bunch of other studies and puts the results together to kind of come to some conclusion based on data from multiple sources that are analyzed in a different kind of a way. They put a lot of data together for these things. And you know what they were looking at was family dinners. They were looking at the impact of more frequent family dinners on disordered eating and nutritional issues and overweight status. And you know what they found after putting the results of a number of different studies together is that families that ate together five times a week or more, the kids in those families were about 25% less likely to be overweight or to have those kinds of nutritional issues than the families who ate together once a week.
Listen, all of this research sort of comes together. You know, if you think about the big picture here, right? A lot of the weight loss programs for kids that are directed at kids,
yeah.
I think this is an evolution in these programs. Mm-hmm. They used to be just, you know, you signed your kid up for Weight Watchers or something,
right? Or sent them to Fat Camp. You used to see Fat Camp, yeah.
And that's it. You know, so now what they've realized is they need to get families involved. And, mm-hmm. and most of the good programs out there incorporate the mom and dad into the program to help deal with this issue, right?
Right. If there's an issue, a good program is going to include the whole family. One of the things that I've been reading a little bit more about is that it might be a little bit more problematic when those programs are happening in schools where the parents aren't necessarily involved, because if you're not targeting someone who has the problem, you're targeting, you know, you're just making blanket statements about the importance of eating right and all of those kinds of things, which is great. But I know that there's some physicians who are concerned that kids who maybe aren't quite on the overweight side of things are going to become anxious about food. And certainly if you look at surveys of parents who are talking about the programs going on in their kids' schools, something like 80% of parents report that there's some kind of weight loss program going on at their kids' schools, but it's not really helping in terms of the bullying of the kids who are overweight and in terms of anxiety and behaviors that might be concerning for parents in terms of too much exercise, being like little kids being overly concerned about the fat content in their food. Kids need some fat in their food, right? They're growing, for Pete's sake. So those blanket programs sometimes, I mean, the risk is that they might raise anxiety. And so again, it comes to parents need to educate themselves about what are the real risk factors so that they can be alert to these things. That's probably why, for one reason why family dinners are helpful, right? Because they're more likely to notice if their child is having a problem with eating, if they're all eating together. It only makes sense. But yeah, parents need to educate their kids. They need to take an active role in all of this. And part of doing that, I think, is by setting an example.
That's it. And another thing that comes out in the research is that, you know, the social support that you get from your parents or mm-hmm. the friends that you have around you,
right,
or aunts and uncles, or just familial support.
Extended family, yeah.
Right. That kind of thing can also be very helpful. And that's why you're seeing the kind of results you're seeing there with
right.
eating dinner together or with these programs where the parents are involved and that kind of thing.
I think the word you used is very important, that what you're saying is support, not criticism, not taking kind of the opposite authoritarian stance, but being supportive.
Supportive understanding.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
There's a study that looked at social problems, and you know, we use this instrument with kids when we test them called the Achenbach checklist, right?
Right, the Achenbach system of empirically based assessment.
Yes, yeah. And one of the scales there is called social problems.
It is.
Right? So they actually took kids, this is a 2010 study, they took 201 obese kids and they looked at kids who were high in social problems versus kids that were low in social problems. Mm-hmm. 35% of the obese kids had high levels of social problems according to these scales.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the kids with these social problems had a higher occurrence of low self-worth, eating disorder symptoms, parental psychological difficulties.
Yeah.
And these same parents that had these psychological difficulties with these kids had social problems.
Right.
And were obese.
Mm-hmm.
They themselves had higher levels of social problems too. Mm. So it gives you an idea of why you need to, like, it's not, you don't just focus on the child.
Right.
You need to know what's behind that too.
Does well, and we've talked.
Need some help to be yes. able to be better socially, because that's one of the things that is carry on to their children, which makes them more anxious, which means that they're more likely to have trouble
right.
with weight.
We have talked again and again and again about concerns that are raised by the fact that families are seem to be more and more isolated, you know, over the decades, that nuclear family tends to hang together, but there's less of an extended network than there used to be. And that's maybe is part of the reason why parents who have social problems wouldn't necessarily notice that their kids are having any kind of unusual social behavior that's getting them into trouble, because they might just say, oh, that's just him, or I was just like that when I was his age.
But programs that are treating the kids need to keep their eyes out for what's happening with the parents as well.
Absolutely.
That's the first thing.
Yeah.
Once you include them, see what context is there to help parents maybe with some adjunct therapy, for instance.
And I'll tell you what, if there's, I think anyway, that there's a big difference between, I know that what my mom used to, mom was busy around the house doing things, and she would say, well, what, go play outside. Right? Because I'd be inside reading a book or whatever, because I was like that. And that's, you could say that to someone who's kind of more sedentary or who's having some of those kinds of weight difficulties. But how much more powerful is it if you go outside with your kids and do something, right? Because actions speak louder than words. We know that. parents of kids who are having any kind of a difficulty, it's not only important to be involved and be supportive, but to be, I think, a role model, an example. That's essential. And that is another reason that the researchers who did that study on family dinners said, you know, you're eating together, you're seeing the parents who are hopefully eating. It tends to be less of the ready-made kinds of meals when it's a whole family dinner and everyone's together. It's an actual slow food, right? It tends to be more like it's slow food. So, I mean, that's setting a good example too. And the teenagers will say, I mean, if you look at the study and the questions that they asked the people who were involved in it, the teenagers said, your family dinners tend to be more healthy than if we're just eating, because usually if we're just eating on our own, we're on the run. And you grab a slice of pizza or you grab, you know, whatever, then it tends to be more processed.
Again, another study it's completely supporting this entire idea that we're developing here, which is support from your parents, support from other people, social support for good eating habits and for helping you stay healthy,
right,
is what you want. Here's another example. Adults who describe themselves as friendly, outgoing, and sociable are more likely to lose weight after being in a weight loss program.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that tell you?
Social.
Just be more sociable.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? They're naturally more connected to other people.
Right.
Because that's their constitution.
They have a support network.
But anyone can have a support network, right? Or anyone, we should think of people as we want to promote healthier social networks for them, regardless of whether they're more extroverted or not.
Mm-hmm.
But we can see that that's something, those kinds of connections, any kind of connection in this case sort of is self-created because of their personality.
Yeah.
But it's helpful.
It absolutely. Well, for a lot of reasons, right? When we've talked about loneliness and connection and all of those things, there's any number of reasons why you need to be connected with somebody else. And, clearly, the social support for adults who are trying to lose weight is essential. You can't do something like that and expect long-term results if you're just doing it on your own in isolation.
You know, there's lots of things you can do to help this along.
Yep.
I think, like I said, if it's tripled over the last 25 years, there's things that have to happen beyond just individual psychology.
Right.
Right. And I think the government's trying to do some of these things. I think there's a government aspect to it. There's an aspect of the food industry.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
Like reducing the fat, sugar, and salt in processed foods and more responsible marketing too. I know that, again, I hate to go back to McDonald's because I know it's sort of like your name. But I don't take my kids there. Partly it's symbolic. Though, you know what I mean? I pick on McDonald's, but it could be a lot of different restaurants that are fast food in that way.
Well, there is a McDonald's literally a 2-minute walk from your house.
There is. Yeah. And the kids go by and say, you know, now they say, ah, that's no good food in there. Because they've
trained them well.
For me.
Yeah.
But, you know, my wife went in there the other day and she said, she went in to use their bathroom.
Because she couldn't make it 2 minutes to get
Wait
home.
A minute, maybe I shouldn't have said that.
Oh my gosh, all the secrets are coming out. Shh.
She went, she went in to take my son to use the bathroom. That's what it was. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that was close. Anyway, they come out and she gets in the car and we start to drive away. And she says, boy, that McDonald's was beautiful. they've renovated the inside.
Yeah.
There's jazz music playing.
Right.
They have cappuccinos now.
Yeah.
And
their coffee is good. Now, I haven't had McDonald's coffee, but from what I hear, their coffee is not bad.
I don't drink coffee, so I wouldn't know.
Right.
But, I mean, the marketing that they're doing to kids, and now I guess they're trying to, because they know that parents
right.
have to bring the kids.
Yep.
So they're kind of stuck. They're trying to figure out a way. But
well, they really, have free Wi-Fi in there and everything.
They do. And, yeah. and you know, they're trying to have healthy food choices in there too.
Yes.
Right? Nobody's buying those healthy food choices.
Not necessarily, no.
but they are there. So they're trying to be responsible to some extent. But I think the marketing, the you know, reducing some of these things in the processed foods, that would be, I think, some of their responsibility.
Right. Education, I think, is still important. Like parents, like you said, you You've worked hard to make sure that your kids know what kind of food is healthy and what kind of food is not so healthy.
That's it. So, you know, we've got what the government can do as well, they, you know, make healthier food more affordable. I mean, you go to the grocery store, it's very expensive to buy healthy food. Like fruits and vegetables are pretty expensive.
Right. But you can get some other things that are less healthy really cheap.
Very cheap, you know. So there's some of that in terms of taxation, what you might be able to do. Mm-hmm. There's the accessibility we talked about, say, in high schools with those vending machines.
Right.
And then there's how are you planning the neighborhood? Like you said, the McDonald's is just down the street from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I already told you that we got into the car.
And you won't.
To drive away.
Wow.
Now, the way this street down the road from me is built, it's not a walking street. I mean, there's many lanes of traffic.
Oh, yeah.
It's not. Yeah. It is going to be redeveloped, though, this coming year. So you may be seeing me walk down next time.
My goodness, you'll be walking.
Well,
what a good example you'll be setting for your kids, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, you're talking about the more societal things, the more community-based interventions that need to be done, but it all starts at home with the role modeling, with being supportive, with shared activities. If you want your kids to go outside and play catch, go outside and play catch.
That's right, but you still need the street.
You need a place to do it.
There so that you don't walk down the street thinking, I hope my five-year-old doesn't jump out in that traffic.
Well, okay. But now we're talking about anatomy of traffic safety.
No. We're talking about listen, you can't just go to psychology. You can't.
I disagree. Psychology you can can't. Solve everything.
You know, if it was just psychology, then how would you wouldn't be able to account for this dramatic rise, right?
Yeah, there's a number of factors.
And you know, we are emphasizing the psychological factors because they're more under individual familial control.
Right.
Right? So obviously it's important to do that. Plus we are psychologists and not sociologists.
Right. We're saying here that education is important and things like that and how the support is important. And one of the things that I think you mentioned earlier on in the show is that there's a stigma or there's a prejudice almost against, well, I say almost, but it's not almost. There is a prejudice against people who are overweight, and there is an advocacy group in the States called the National Association for Advancement of Fat Acceptance. And I don't know if they go too far in the other direction, but certainly a couple of their messages are, you know, don't bully people just because they're bigger than you are. You know, accept people for who they are and accept people for the way they look. And a healthy diet and healthy eating is all well and good, but you have to be careful about the prejudice that exists against people who are overweight.
Well, listen, I know you mentioned that just before the show started. If you think about it, we've had women's rights movements, gay rights movements, children's rights movements as well, right? Yeah. We haven't really had people who, I don't even know what you would call it, overweight rights? No, you wouldn't call it that either, right?
You get a few people, well, I mean, these guys are calling it fat acceptance. But,
okay, so they're using the word to take some of the stigma away.
Sure. Remember Kevin Smith on that airline who was ejected for being too big for his seat. And that caused it was all over the news, right? Because he has so many Twitter followers and he was tweeting about what was happening on this plane where he was ejected.
That's right. He was very angry and humiliated, but yeah. I think he's using that energy in a positive way. Here's an interesting study. Now tell me what you think of this. 2012 study from the University of Alabama.
Okay.
There's a lot of studies, I guess, in the last 20, 30 years that have been using functional MRIs.
Ah, brain scans.
Brain scans.
Right.
And so while they're scanning your brain, mm-hmm. they get you to do some different tasks.
Right.
And then they see what kind of difference that shows up on the brain scan.
Exactly.
What parts of your brain light up.
The functional MRIs are different from other kinds of technology that we've had in the past because instead of being like a photograph of your brain, it's like a movie.
That's right. So now they have 25 overweight adults, 21 normal weight adults. And
I read this study a while ago,
actually.
Did
you see this? Yeah. So what they wanted to see is if they showed people pictures of high calorie food, right?
what parts of their brain would light up.
What would happen? Mm-hmm. When they showed the pictures of high-calorie foods to overweight adults, the brain centers for rewards, that light up whenever you're getting a reward, and for increased focus, really light up in overweight people. And that's not the same with the normal weight individuals.
Exactly.
So what does that mean?
What does it mean? Is it learning? Is it something that they've learned that is rewarding to them?
See that? Right? Yeah.
Is it genetic?
Uh-huh.
Who, you know, it's now, that's something that's really hard to tease apart, right?
It is, but I think the way it's, when you see this in the newspapers, right?
Because what are they going to say? Yeah.
Right? It's the kind of study that's going to show up in the newspaper.
They're going to say, baby, they're born that way.
They're born that way, right? They're born, look at them. Their brain lights up when they can't help it. They're born to, you know, overeat because that's the reward and focus.
And let's be clear, for some people, yes, it is really hard to resist those kinds of treats.
But it might be really hard because of what they've learned over time.
Sure. It could,
right? It doesn't
either way.
Mean that they were born that way.
No. No, it doesn't.
Now, every time I say that, of course, I think of Lady Gaga. Thank you.
I did that on purpose because I knew you would.
Right. But I mean, it's important. I think I brought that up specifically, I think, to give people an idea that it can be a little misleading when you read something like that in the newspaper. What we're focused on more is, from a psychological point of view, is how support from your spouse towards your child, family involvement,
family dinners, family involvement, family activities
is going to be helpful.
Absolutely. And that brings us to
top three things.
Let's do it. And the number one thing to remember is that parents need to set an example. Family meals can be really important in terms of encouraging healthy eating. Shared activities can also encourage exercise and being more active. It's much more effective to go outside and toss a frisbee around with your kid than just sending them out on their own. That's my bias because I love playing frisbee with the kids.
And the second thing you should remember is if you're looking to lose weight, do what is recommended, of course. Reduce fat intake, reduce sugar intake, increase fruits and vegetables, increase physical activity, which, by the way, is the best predictor of weight maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
But from a psychological point of view, seek out support of others. If you're concerned about your child, give them the kind of supportive relationship that will help them lose weight or at least accept themselves as they are.
Exactly. And the third thing to remember is that education is really important. Before parents become critical of their child's eating habits, they should educate themselves on what are the risk factors, what are the signs that worrisome eating habits are developing. Look for those, be sensitive about it, and you'll be ahead of the game.
And that's it for us. You can email us at info@familyanatomy.com or visit us at our website at familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. And as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love. And he's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
See you in 2 weeks. A family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com